Chapter 40. Paris, June 1934. It seems strange to Alice that her time in the city has been as short as 4 years, for it is home to her now, the centre of her own particular universe. She could walk the streets near her rooms with a blindfold tied over her eyes and know where she is at all times. If she ever thinks about all those years she lived in London, it appalls her to think that she never understood the city, never knew the fine arterial network of streets that connected those places she might have passed in the back seat of a car. There are those who say that Paris is not what it was in the 1920s, when the city was awash with money and the sort of happy abandonment that accompanies a time of prosperity. There is no one interesting dinner at the Ritz now, they claim. The arts are not what they were, now that so many of the great writers and painters have left in search of pastures new. Those big expatriate names, the Hemingways, the Fitzgeralds, the Joyces, all gone. Alice, never having known that Paris, cannot imagine a more exciting place than the one she inhabits now. She has found herself another prospective job. It has come to her through Madame Fouillet, whose sister works as the housekeeper for a wealthy family in the 16th arrondissement. "They are looking for a governess," she told Alice. "I told Bertrand you'd be perfect." "Why?" "Come, my dear, it's easy to see that you are bright, even educated. I've seen you racing through those books you bring back. Besides, and you mustn't take this the wrong way, you clearly aren't meant to be a waitress."
"It's been so long since I was at school."
"You needn't worry about that. The children have a tutor for more subjects. He comes every day."
"Then what am I needed for?"
"English. The parents want them to learn it, though goodness knows why people think English is of any use to anybody. They want someone who will teach them to speak it naturally, you know, as well as a British person might. They're good employers, Bertrand says, if you don't mind permitting their sort a bit of oddness."
"What sort?"
"You know, Jews."
Alice's first meeting with Madame de Rosé is something of a surprise. She had expected a great and lofty personage befitting of the house, a building of which her mother would approve, built to awe and intimidate. Sophie de Rosé, however, confounds her preconceptions. Alice is shown into the morning salon, a white temple of a room flooded with the green light of the garden beyond the windows. In this space, Madame de Rosé seems small and very young. In fact, she appears barely older than Alice herself, in her late 20s at the most. Her face is an almost perfect oval, with a small mouth and large dark eyes. It is a face that could be solemn, pious even, were it not for the smile of welcome.
"So you are Alice?"
She speaks in English, but nervously, as though unfamiliar with the feel of the language in her mouth. Alice nods.
"You speak French?"
"Yes."
This is evidently a relief. Madame de Rosé moves gratefully into her mother tongue.
"Good. Let us sit."
Alice takes a seat indicated, and for a moment her attention is caught by the painting behind Madame de Rosé's head. It is a study of an orchard, a work of green and light. White spaces of empty canvas show through the branches of the trees, but the result is not so much one of incompleteness as of a greater realism than had they been filled in with paint, the effect of a pale spring sun penetrating the canopy of new leaves. Madame de Rosé catches Alice looking.
"Cézanne," she says. "I was wondering if it might be. I've seen some of his work in the Gallery Luxembourg."
"My husband is a great follower of the arts. Both of us are, but he knows about the different movements, the new techniques and styles emerging. I only know what I like."
Madame de Rosé gives a shy smile. "It's beautiful. One of the loveliest I've seen of his."
"Thank you. It seems we share the same taste."
It is Alice who feels she should introduce the purpose of this meeting, for Madame de Rosé appears in no hurry to do so.
"I understand you're looking for a governess."
"Yes, sir, we are. To the matter in hand, as my husband would say. You come with excellent recommendations."
Alice shifts in her seat. She hasn't heard anything of these recommendations, though it wouldn't surprise her if this were Madame Fouillet's work. Madame de Rosé seems to interpret her discomfort as modesty. If I am honest, she says, sitting forward in her chair, the most important recommendation of all is that you are actually English. I am, though I live here now. I think of Paris as my home. But you could teach my children English ways and customs, and teach them the proper English, not that of a foreigner, however fluent. Perhaps if there is any time left after the children's lessons, you might instruct me, too. Alice is introduced to the children. Antoine, 5, cripplingly shy, and barely able to look her in the eye for more than a few seconds, and the girl, Marguerite, with that peculiar self-possession especial to 6-year-old girls.
You don't look very old, she tells Alice challengingly.
No, I suppose I'm not.
I thought all governesses had to be. Our tutor is. He's a fossil.
On her way out, Alice's attention is caught by another beautiful object, an elaborate 8-armed candelabra, wrought in silver. It's exquisite, she says. Madame de Rosé is suddenly ill at ease.
It's an heirloom from my husband's family, she says hurriedly, then adds, but you know, we think of ourselves as French, first and foremost.
Alice is nonplussed. Yes, of course. Several weeks on, Alice sits once more with her new employer. Why is it that you want your family to learn the language? Alice asks. They speak in English now as often as possible. Sophie insists upon it. She must be pushed, she explains, or she will become lazy.
It's a wonderful language.
Sophie takes a careful sip of her tisane and regards Alice over the fine rim of her cup as if trying to come to a decision.
There is another reason, though. Monsieur de Rosé and I. For some time now we have been considering a move to England.
Why?
Well, you know, things have been, she hesitates, more difficult for my husband of late.
In what way?
I realize it has been harder for everyone the last few years, and we have been lucky by most standards. For us, business is still good. You wouldn't think people would be buying fur in a depression, but it seems French women consider it a necessity. There is, however, a certain resentment towards those of our kind. Not that it hasn't always been there to a degree. Of late, though, it has been more, shall we say, energetic.
Do you believe England will be better? Alice thinks of her stepfather and his cronies.
Perhaps, perhaps not. Monsieur de Rosé has family in London, and there is talk of moving the business, joining with them, a new start for us.
But you won't go soon.
Not right away. It will take some time to get our affairs in order. Besides, we won't go until we can speak the language like locals. Monsieur de Rosé doesn't believe that he needs any help with his English, but then it is true that, one way or another, he seems to be able to make himself understood wherever he goes.
Ah, you are so good with the children, Sophie says. We couldn't take them away from you so soon, even if we wanted to.
I am certain they wouldn't allow it.
Thank you, Alice says, touched. She has become fond of them in return. The girl with her fierce intelligence, picking up whole phrases easily, almost greedily, and challenging Alice to explain quirks of grammar and pronunciation.
Why did they decide to spell dove and move the same? She demands. If they wanted them to sound so different.
And the boy, slower to understand than his sister, but still almost a baby, really, who likes to sit with his small, warm arm curled around Alice's neck as she reads to him, his breath across her cheek sweet and vaguely milk-scented.
I don't only mean the teaching, though, Sophie says with a smile. You have such a tender way with them. If it wouldn't put poor old Nanny Bissette out of a job, I'd have you looking after them all the time. I know they would prefer it, too. She regards Alice curiously. You must want to have children of your own some day.
Alice nods mutely.
I'm sorry, Sophie says quickly, sensing something amiss. That was too forward of me.
Alice shakes her head. No, she says. It's not, it's... She takes a deep breath, hardly believing she is going to say it.
There was one. A baby girl.
She died.
Oh, Alice.
In one swift movement, Sophie has gone to Alice's seat and put her arms around her. The suddenness of it causes something in Alice to yield, and she feels a single hot, wet tear slide down her cheek. She brushes it away and tries to remember the last time someone comforted her in this way. She finds, to her surprise, that she cannot. A pattern is soon established. The children have their lesson first for a couple of hours. Sophie's tutorial follows, but it doesn't seem formal enough to count as such. The two of them sit in the morning room and simply talk together, no topic out of bounds, or rather, no topic save that of Tom. Alice has avoided mentioning him, not because she doesn't think Sophie would understand, far from it, but because she fears that doing so would be too painful. Afterwards, Sophie almost always invites Alice to stay for lunch, sometimes with the children in the nursery, and sometimes just the two of them in the airy breakfast room at the front of the house. One day, walking back to Fouillet's, Alice understands for the first time her great relief at knowing that the De Rosés' move to England is not imminent. It is not simply the prospect of losing the companionship of the children or the satisfaction of the work. It is that she appears to have found in Sophie De Rosé, unexpectedly, what she has not truly had since Tom. A friend. The thoughts of Tom haven't left her, though, and now it feels as if the tears shed earlier have caused some sort of transformation within her. She feels emboldened, even reckless. Has she allowed enough time to pass? She isn't sure, but she sits down to write to him all the same. A secret part of her longs to tell him the truth, but she must not. The larger, more sensible part of her knows this to be so. Instead, she tells him, with no small pride, of her new independence. She describes Madame de Rosé, the American writer, her room at Fouillet's. And she gives him the return address, care of Madame F. Does she secretly hope that, armed with this, he will board the first boat across the channel and come in search of her? She will not allow herself to examine her feelings too closely. It would, she knows, be an absurd hope. She tells herself this when a package arrives instead. Smallish, card-bagged. She opens it carefully and discovers a letter and a sketch wrapped in oilcloth, the ink already beginning to fade with age. There she is by the lake, sitting beneath the overarching boughs of those twin elderly willows. She remembers the languorous heat of the day. She recalls, too, how she felt Tom's eyes upon her as she removed her clothes and how she reveled in it, the awareness of her power over him. And the evening afterwards, Alice feels a pressure within her chest, almost as though she might be about to cry again. She turns quickly to the letter, in the hope of distraction.
1st of September, 1934. Dearest A, what it is to hear from you, and to know that you are happy. You are often in my thoughts, so now I can picture you more accurately, writing your letter, looking out across the rooftops of the city. Pardon me for saying this, but I can't imagine you as a governess. Perhaps it is because it is such an indoor role, and I only ever seem to be able to imagine you outside, but I am glad you are enjoying it. I should say first that I have some sad news. Last week, Father took his own life. It was Ma who found him, and she is beside herself. And yet, though it is a terrible thing to say, I can't help feeling it has also come as a relief. He had been so much worse in recent years that caring for him had become a daily trial, and I'm not sure Ma could see in him the man she married. Understandably, she no longer wishes to remain in the house in Putney. Tomorrow she will move to Islington to stay with Rosa and her family. I left the job on Silk Street yesterday. It was making me dull and unimaginative. I had begun to realize how much it was affecting my painting, and it scared me. I managed to sell 6 pieces, would you believe it, to a man your Aunt Margaret put me in touch with. Incredibly, I made from this sale almost what I would earn in 5 months at Locke and Proudfoot. So I am headed to New York. As I see it, there are 2 cities in the world where a would-be artist should want to be at the moment, and they are New York and Paris. I don't want to be another Englishman like Rupert Grant, travelling to France to try to copy Picasso. They say New York is the place now, where artists are moving beyond what they have learned from Europe. I have enough from the paintings and my savings to pay for my passage, and I hope for a modest rent and living expenses for several months. It must seem unfeeling for me to be leaving so soon after my father's death, but Ma is positively encouraging me to go. I would never have gone without her full blessing. I'm putting most of my work in storage over here, but when I discovered this drawing of you, I didn't want to consign it to some dry, dark place. I hope it will remind you of the fun we had together. My ship leaves Southampton in a couple of days' time, and the crossing, weather permitting, should not take more than 5 or 6 days. Incredible, when one thinks that not so long ago it might have taken as much time to get to Europe. For the first week or so, I will be staying with an American fellow I knew at Oxford, Eddie Bloomberg. I can't recall if you ever met him. I doubt it. Eddie is far too charming for me to have risked the introduction if I had any sense. After my time with Eddie, I will try to find a place of my own, somewhere ideally right in the middle of it all. Eddie has offered to help me look, though I suspect his standards may be loftier than my budget will allow. I shall write again when I have crossed the Atlantic. There, doesn't that sound like something? Yours, T.
He sounds, what? Happy. Well, good. Alice is pleased for him, and yet she cannot do anything about the ache in her chest that forms at the thought of him moving yet farther away from her, towards a new life. It is absurd, she knows. She was the one to enact the first separation, after all. But if Alice has learned anything from the previous few years, it is that feelings are not rational and cannot always be suppressed in the way one might like.